Episode 18, The Beginning of the Holocaust. I took my sick mother and started out on the way to Babi Yar. Hundreds, no thousands of Jews were walking the same way. An old Jew with a long white beard walked next to me. He wore a talis and tefillin. He was murmuring quietly. He prayed the same way as my father did when I was a child. Ahead of me, a woman with two children in her arms walked along, while the third child clung to her apron strings. The sick women and elderly people were taken by carts, on which bags and suitcases were piled up. Small children were crying. The older people, who had difficulty walking, were sighing in a barely audible way, but they silently continued their path of sorrow. Russian husbands accompanied their Jewish wives. Russian wives accompanied their Jewish husbands. When we neared Babi Yar, shooting and inhuman cries could be heard. I started to grasp what was going on, but said nothing to my mother. When we entered the gate, we were ordered to hand over our documents and valuables, and to take off our clothes. One German approached my mother and tore her gold ring off her finger. Only then did my mother say to me, "Dinochka, you are Pronichiva, a Russian. You should save yourself. Run to your little ones. You should live for them." But I could not run. All around were standing fascists armed with submachine guns, Ukrainian policemen and fierce dogs ready to tear a human apart. Furthermore, how could I leave my mother alone? I hugged her, burst into tears, but I could not leave her. Each time I saw a new group of men and women, elderly people and children, they were forced to take off their clothes. All were being taken to an open pit where submachine gunners shot them. Then another group was brought. With my own eyes I saw this horror. Although I was not standing close to the pit, terrible cries of panic-stricken people and quiet children's voices calling, "Mother, mother," reached me. I saw all this, but in no way could I understand how people were killing other human beings only because they were Jews. And then I understood that fascists are not human beings, but beasts. I saw a young woman, completely naked, nursing her naked baby when a policeman came running up to her, tore the baby from her breast, and threw it into the pit alive. The mother rushed there after her baby. The fascist shot her, and she fell down, dead. Then the policeman ordered me to strip and pushed me to a precipice, where another group of people were awaiting their fate. But before the shots resounded, apparently out of fear, I fell into the pit. I fell on the bodies of those already murdered. During the first moments, I couldn't grasp anything, either where I was or how I got there. I thought that I'd gone mad, but when people started to fall on top of me, I regained consciousness and understood everything. I started to feel my arms, legs, stomach, and head to make certain that I'd not even been wounded. I pretended to be dead. Those who had been killed or wounded were lying under me and on top of me. Many were still breathing. Others were moaning. Suddenly I heard a child weeping and the cry, "Mummy." I imagined my little girl crying and I started to cry myself. The shooting was continuing and people kept falling. I threw bodies off of me, afraid of being buried alive. Suddenly all became quiet. It was getting dark. Germans armed with submachine guns walked around, finishing off the wounded. I felt that somebody was standing above me, but I did not give any sign that I was alive, even though that was very difficult. Then I felt we were being covered with earth. I closed my eyes so that the soil would not get into them, and when it became dark and silent, literally the silence of death, I opened my eyes and threw the sand off me, making sure that no one was close by, no one was around, no one was watching me. I saw the pits with thousands of dead bodies. I was overcome by terror. In some places the earth was heaving. People half alive were still breathing. I looked at myself and was terror-stricken. The undershirt covering my naked body was soaked with blood. I tried to stand up, but was unable to do so. Then I said to myself, "Dina, stand up. Get away. Run from here. Your children are waiting for you." So I stood up and ran. Testimony of Dina Pronicheva on the Baba Yar Massacre. Welcome to The Finest Half Hour, read by Richard Cutland, written by Jim Jager, and brought to you with the generous support of Wargaming. This will be the most important episode we ever bring you. It will also be the most difficult. We'll begin with a warning. This episode, by its nature, will discuss things that are horrific, terrifying, traumatic. You should continue listening anyway. Because today we're going to talk about the beginnings of the Holocaust. The early days, before it turned into the industrialized slaughter of the later war. We're going to cover the part before the camps, before the liquidation of the ghettos. We're going to talk about the part that most people will know less about. Because we must remember where the murders began. With a eugenics program, with the execution of children, with unrestrained slaughter in the East. There will be no big battles, no talk of tanks or the manoeuvre of armies in today's episode. There won't even be the vignettes we usually give you, the stories we've mashed together from accounts of the war. The only way we can do this justice is to give you the experience of survivors in their own words. It may be hard to hear, hard to listen to, but we urge you to, because it's easy to get lost in the heroic fantasy of World War II and forget that it was a tragedy on the grandest scale. It's easy to get swept up in the brilliance of the battles and forget that the Nazis were monsters who perpetrated the worst crimes in human history. It's easy to romanticize the war, especially 80 years out, and tune out the atrocities and the suffering that it brought. And we must never forget. Action, T4. We regret we must inform you that your son, who had to be moved to our institution following a ministerial order in accord with an instruction from the Reichsdefense Commissioner, unexpectedly died of pneumonia at Am Spiegelgrund. Considering their severe incurable illness, their death comes to them as a relief. From letter sent to parents after the murder of handicapped children. Before the camps, before even the Einsatzgruppen, the roving butcher squads we'll spend most of today talking about, the Nazi regime began its program of mass murder with children, specifically those with disabilities. Early in Hitler's rise to power, he mandated a program of what he called racial hygiene. Based in the pseudo-scientific eugenics theories of the 19th century, theories which denied the basic humanity of anyone with a genetic disability and tried to convince the world that they were no more than a burden on society. This program called for the forced sterilization of anyone with a congenital defect or mental illness. This was extended to people who were considered to have antisocial disorders, anyone who was homosexual or struggling with things like alcoholism, the blind and the deaf, and even mixed-race children of African descent. But in 1939, he went one step further and began a program of covert murder. It would later be called Action T4, after the clean, whitewashed offices where the bureaucracy of death took place. Starting in 1939, doctors and nurses were required to report to the state every newborn with severe disabilities, or children under 3 suspected of having a severe hereditary disease were to be killed. Panels were set up at many of the major psychiatric hospitals to decide which patients were incapable of work and thus, as the Nazis called them, life unworthy of life. Many of those were children or teenagers. Their parents were told that they were to be moved to special facilities for better treatment. Then, after a few weeks, their parents would be sent a letter saying they died tragically of a disease. In truth, they were injected with phenobarbital, gassed, or simply tortured to death, and then, often, their brains were harvested and placed in jars of formaldehyde, ostensibly for science, though many ended up in the macabre collections of the doctors who carried out these murders. As late as 2001, the brains of children murdered by Nazis were still being found in private hands. It was a trial run for the Holocaust. It was here that the Nazis discovered the use of showers to lull victims into a false sense of security. It was here that they first tested out gassing on a mass scale. It was here that they discovered that with a little bit of official-seeming paperwork, they could get ordinary individuals to carry out monstrous acts. Then began the invasion of Poland. In the chaos of war, even the vague veneer of legality, of official formality, was thrown out. Teens labelled delinquents, often for no other reason than being Jewish or Roma, were euthanized. Einsatzgruppen, Hitler's mobile killing squads, simply shot any adults with disabilities they found. To open up beds for wounded German soldiers, they'd march into hospitals, round up anyone they considered inferior, and herd them outside to be shot. Meanwhile, in Germany, the pace of killing accelerated as well. Over 80,000 people with disabilities would be killed by the time that the Action T4 program was officially shuttered in 1941. But the German Federal Archives have shown that the killings continued until the end of the war, probably numbering into the hundreds of thousands. Operation Tannenberg. During potato digging time in 1939, Oberwachtmeister Wittke from Wejherowo came to our village and called me and all the workers from Linjevo to report for work in the woods. It was at twilight. The forester took us to the woods and personally marked an area 8 meters long and 4 meters wide and ordered us to dig 2 ditches, 2.5 meters deep. He warned us to keep quiet about this work. And in the morning he gave each of us 10 to 15 zlotys for digging the ditch. The same group of people dug about 10 such ditches. 2 or 3 days later, around noon, rifle shots could be heard, and afterwards machine gun fire. The shooting went on for an hour. The shots came exactly from the site where we had dug the ditches. I guessed that Poles were being executed at those ditches. That was what the entire German population of our village thought. In the evening, they again came to us and took us, carrying shovels to that ditch, ordering us to fill it up. The ditch was already partly covered with earth, and there remained about 1.5 meters to fill. From under the sand, there slightly protruded human limbs or parts of civilian clothing. Around the ditch, within a radius of 10 meters, I noticed blood, teeth, pieces of jaws with teeth, and even pieces of bone from human skulls. On the trunks of the trees near the ditch, I saw bits of human brain, at a height of about 1.5 meters. For sodding the graves, they paid us 5 zlotys each. Testimony on the massacres at Pierznica. I was walking alone when I reached the woods near Pierznica. I was stopped by a German Wehrmacht soldier who asked me where I was going. Before, while I was approaching the soldier, I had heard some moaning and crying, but I didn't know where the sounds were coming from, because there was a very strong wind. When I explained to the soldier that I was bound for Linjevo, he asked me whether I didn't know the entrance to the forest along this road was forbidden. He told me to wait there until he returned, and then the soldier went into the woods. Waiting there, I looked around and noticed trucks standing some distance away in the wood. About 100 meters from where I was, I noticed people crawling around near ditches. I guessed that an execution was taking place. It was then around 9 a.m. Next, I saw, near the crawling people I mentioned before, one SS man in uniform, who held a small child by its legs. This SS man then tore the child apart and threw it against the tree. While I noticed that shocking scene, two SS men approached me with the soldier to whom I had talked before. The Germans asked me why I had come along that road, and whether I didn't know that the road was closed. They also asked me whether I knew them and what kind of uniform they were wearing. I said I didn't know them, and also had no idea what kind of uniform they were wearing. Next, they asked me whether I had noticed trucks in the woods or anything else, which I denied. After that talk, one of the SS men declared that he was going to take me along, but the other one interfered, saying that they had no more ammunition. They wrote down my personal data, and when I told them that I lived in the village of Ulla, one of them said that it was a German village. Then they told me to stay where I was, and they left while I was to wait with the soldier. When the SS men had left, the soldier told me to return home. I did not tell anybody what I had gone through, because I feared reprisals from the Germans. I remember that, while standing in the forest, after the soldier had stopped me, I saw some distance away the priest from Mekowara, named Witkowski, hung on a tree. Testimony on the massacres at Pieśnica. Before the Germans invaded Poland, they made a list of 61,000 Polish civilians. Every person on that list was to be murdered as soon as the conquest of the country was complete. The list was of artists, intellectuals, clergy, politicians and activists. It was a list of the people who helped steer Polish society and drive Polish culture. Hitler wanted them dead because he wanted to kill Polish political and cultural life. Racist Nazi ideology saw the Polish people as work animals, fit for nothing but manual labour. Everyone on Hitler's list made it obvious how much of a lie that was. So long as those people lived, Hitler feared Polish citizens would not accept Germans as their masters. As long as those people lived, Nazis wouldn't be able to wipe out Polish political and cultural identity, thus giving the people something to rally to and causing them to rebel. So the people on the list were to be murdered. Quickly and brutally. And here's where the Einsatzgruppen began. This was a group whose job, in the words of one SS general after the war, was the annihilation of the Jews, Gypsies, the Romani people, and Soviet political commissars. They were created as roving death squads that would follow the army and butcher anyone the Reich deemed undesirable. They operated in conjunction with the Wehrmacht, relying on the army for supply, lodging, and transportation. They reported their activities to local army commanders to make sure that no one interfered with their program of murder, torture, and genocide. And, as the war went on, there would be an ever-increasing number of reports of Wehrmacht troops participating in atrocities. During their first test run in Poland, they took to their task with such zeal that they far exceeded the list of 61,000. They didn't just target Polish cultural figures. They'd go into a village, demand that all the Jews be brought out, and then herd them into a building to burn them alive. They'd march into psychiatric wards and simply shoot every patient in the head. If anyone resisted, they'd kill 100 Poles for every German killed. But Poland was just the beginning of the Einsatzgruppen terror. Barbarossa gave them an opportunity to accelerate their program of murder and put it into practice on a yet more horrific scale. Generalplan Ost. I saw them do the killing. At 5 p.m. they gave the command, fill in the pits. Screams and groans were coming from the pits. Suddenly, I saw my neighbour, Rudermann, rise from under the soil. His eyes were bloody and he was screaming, "Finish me off." A murdered woman lay at my feet. A boy of 5 years crawled out from under her body and began to scream desperately. "Mommy!" That was all I saw. I fell unconscious. Testimony on the massacres at Pyryatyn. As the Nazi horde swept east during Operation Barbarossa, the Einsatzgruppen followed close behind, and they brought with them a level of suffering and cruelty never before experienced in the modern world. Starting in 1933, almost immediately after Hitler's rise to power, the Nazi Party began to strip Jewish citizens of their legal rights, and every year things got worse. By the beginning of the invasion of the USSR, Nazi ideology labelled Slavic people as Untermensch, subhumans with no rights, and Jews as a race to be exterminated. Generalplan Ost, the Nazis' master plan for the East, called for depopulating the region and colonising it with German settlers, using those Slavs and Poles who remained as slave labour for the new colonists. Jews were to be eliminated entirely. That was the task of the Einsatzgruppen. In the old Russian Empire, Eastern Europe, the first place conquered by the Nazis in their push east, was known as the Pale of Settlement. Due to the anti-Semitism of that regime, it was the only place in the empire where Jewish people were legally allowed to live. When World War II began, it contained the largest concentration of Jewish people in the world. With its conquest, it became a hunting ground for the Nazi killing squads. At first, their actions were crude, brutal murders, disorganized, opportunistic. They would haul Jews out of houses where they found them and shoot them. They would round up villages, separate out the Jews, and burn them alive in their synagogues. Then, the sadism grew. They would crack people's skulls open with their entrenching tools. They would have people lie down, and then stand on their necks until they suffocated. They would have them dig their own graves, and then bury them alive. But we have records of the Nazi hierarchy reprimanding the Einsatzgruppen for not killing Jews fast enough. In an act of inhumane banality, they were given quotas that they were supposed to meet. So the scale of killing grew, and new techniques were implemented. When Kiev was captured, they put up posters around the city that read, "All Jews of the city of Kiev and its vicinity must appear on Monday, September the 29th, by 8 o'clock in the morning, at the corner of Melnikova and Dokterevskaya Streets, near the Vyshkova Cemetery. Bring documents, money and valuables, and also warm clothing, linen, etc. Any Jews who do not follow this order and are found elsewhere will be shot. Any civilians who enter the dwellings left by Jews and appropriate the things in them will be shot." By telling them to bring their belongings, they convinced people that they were just going to be deported. Preferring that to death, tens of thousands of people showed up. They were herded away in small groups, as if to go to some form of transportation waiting to deport them. Then, in a forest by a ravine, mostly still unsuspecting, they were told to put down their belongings. Then they were made to strip. Then they were shot. It took 2 days of constant killing to murder the Jewish population of Kiev. No man, woman, or child was spared. Of the 33,771 Jews that answered the Nazis' call, only 29 would not end up as corpses, piled up in the bottom of the ravine of Babi Yar. In Odessa, in retaliation for the destruction of the local Romanian military headquarters, which had been rigged to explode by Soviet NKVD agents before the Soviets abandoned the city, members of the Einsatzgruppen and local collaborators rounded up tens of thousands of Jews. This time they had built special buildings to force the Jews into, which had holes cut in the walls to stick machine guns through, and which were pre-doused with gasoline so they could be set alight when the killing was through. Even more ways to make mass murder more and more efficient were being developed. They began to experiment with sealed vans that would use poison gas to kill anyone riding in the back as they drove, so the bodies could simply be dumped when they got to a remote location. These had been first developed for small-scale operations during Action T4, but now were being tried for much larger operations. The Einsatz group and commanders reported back that this was still not efficient enough. They wanted to industrialise the process of mass murder, so plans for the first death camps were drawn up. And, as Einsatzgruppen members wandered the countryside, treating the populace with bestial brutality, murdering in broad daylight, gunning down Jews in the streets, where was the army? It was still right there, supporting them, sometimes even aiding in operations. There was never a large-scale movement for the Einsatzgruppen to be disbanded from any level of the army. In fact, the principal complaint from the army was that the death squads were using too much ammunition, leading to the famous order from the commander of the 6th Army that the Einsatzgruppen limit themselves to 2 bullets per Jew. The Geneva Convention. From the second floor, we saw about 100 men, stripped to the waist, but apparently soldiers, judging from their trousers. Many were Russians, and it was after the invasion of their country in 1941. They were killed in a vicious manner. I saw some hit with spades that split their heads. Others were told to lie down with spades over their throats. Then the SS stood on each end and suffocated them. Some stood on the edge of a pit and fell into it after being kicked in the groin. Then the SS threw large stones at them. They told prisoners to lie down, loaded wagons with sand, and then tipped them over and buried the men alive. That was the most horrible thing I ever saw. They probably killed half of the men before noon. Then they went to lunch. When they had eaten, they killed off the rest of them. None of the prisoners were shot. Instead, they were murdered in the most brutal way. Testimony on the treatment of Soviet prisoners of war. Though the Jews were the principal focus of the Einsatzgruppen, they were not alone in being the victims of Nazi mass murder. Homosexuals and Romani, Poles and Serbs, Freemasons and Jehovah's Witnesses were all marked for extinction, as were many other groups. But, after the Jews, the largest group to be targeted were members of the Soviet Union, especially prisoners of war. When Germany invaded the USSR, Hitler sent his top generals an order. Russian political commissars captured on the battlefield were to be executed immediately, even if they were unarmed, even if they surrendered. Wehrmacht troops had orders to shoot them. And with this order came the statement that even though Germany was a signatory of the Geneva Convention, Soviet prisoners of war were not to be treated with the rights afforded other prisoners. They were starved to death en masse, stripped of their clothes and placed in POW camps that had no shelter, just barbed wire and guard towers, and left to freeze in the winter. They were tortured, experimented on, or worked to death, or just shot on the march to a camp because they were inconvenient. Over the course of the war, over 3 million Soviet POWs would die in Nazi hands. No law, no moral code, no act of faith or prescription of scripture could stem the tide of blood. The Nazi death cult, driven by racist ideology and absolute unswerving loyalty to their dictator, would continue their murders up to the last days of the war. As the Reich was falling apart, supplies and equipment desperately needed for defence of the homeland continued to be allocated for the slaughter of civilians. and almost no one in Germany spoke out against it, even though rumours of what was happening out east made the killings an open secret. And those few who did, like anti-Nazi student activist Sophie Schull, often found themselves meeting the same fate as those they tried to defend. So we'll just leave you with one more testimonial before we go. A few days after war began, the Germans arrived with tanks. I saw many people lying on the ground and couldn't understand what was happening. I'd never seen things like that. I asked my mother, and she said they were all killed. That's the nicest way she could put it. But you know children, they try and understand. Gradually, things changed. They attacked women on the streets and ordered them to dig graves. Then they told them to undress and shot them in the breasts. Some people were still alive when buried. We had to close our shops and prepare to go to the ghetto. One young man with blonde hair and blue eyes was very wealthy and extremely brave. It didn't matter who you were. Marek Lieberman was very good to all, but someone denounced him. They came to his house, took all his cash, and took him to the market to be hanged. We were told to watch, and I was 5 feet away from him when he was killed. It's engraved on my mind. I can't forget it. It's always with me. I saw a mother walking with her dead baby and crying while singing to her. When I was 14, I saw another mother talking to her daughter. She held the child protectively in her arms as a German soldier came forward, took out his gun, and shot the little girl. How can you erase something like that? You don't even have to close your eyes. It's always with you. Zelda Bokaska Brodecki, from the archives of the United States Holocaust Museum. Never forget.